Chapter 5, An Immense Bell Ringing. John Paul was a Marian whose love of Christ led, inevitably according to his thinking and ardently in keeping with his nature, to love of Christ's mother. He learned his devotion firsthand in a childhood in Poland, one of the great Marian countries. It is interesting that the countries whose Catholics love Mary most ardently, and who have by tradition been most public in that love, have tended to be those that have known intense political oppression and poverty. Poland, Ireland, Mexico, Italy, the Philippines. Why would this be? Well, maybe protracted trouble helps human beings admit they need as much help as they can get, and if a father, son, and mother are available, they'll take all three. Maybe in part it's that families under daily duress experience more deeply the crucial importance of women because they witness it each day, in the home and in the form of decision-making and direction. When you live close to the land, I think you tend to absorb also a strong sense of gender, of the differentness of the sexes. This might prompt the assumption that you need not only a masculine presence in your life, but a feminine one, too. In our world, the modern and technologized one in which we live, we like to think of men and women as the same. We even try to make them the same. But they're not the same. They are equal, but different. John Paul was captivated by Mary. He said he saw her quite literally as his mother. Since his youngest days, he had worn around his neck an old brown scapular, a cloth sort of chain and cloth medal bearing a likeness of the Virgin Mary. He said it was a help and defense in times of danger, a seal of peace, and a sign of Mary's care. John Paul believed that she has literally intervened in human history in the many centuries since she left this world, and intensely in the past two centuries. He believed the Blessed Mother has come to us and visited us in once obscure towns with names like Fatima in Portugal, Lourdes in France, Knock in Ireland, Guadalupe in Mexico, and that on these visits she has offered encouragement, affection, and guidance. These visitations were very real to John Paul. They were not abstract to him or merely symbolic. They were not imagined by children and told by old ladies. They were actual moments in human history. They happened. On May 13, 1981, when John Paul had been pope for 2.5 years, he was shot in St. Peter's Square by a young man wielding a Browning 9mm semi-automatic pistol. John Paul was in a small open-air truck that was driving slowly by the crowd that had come to see him at his weekly audience. After the shooting, the Vatican would order the bulletproof vehicle that came to be called the Pope-mobile. But on this day he was in the open-air truck. It was a bright spring afternoon, 5 p.m. About 20,000 people were there. He waved to and blessed them as they jumped up and down and cheered. Then he stopped the truck and picked up a little girl held toward him by her parents. He held her, smiled, handed her back. The open-air truck moved on, heading towards the bronze doors of the Apostolic Palace. Two shots suddenly pierced the air. One grazed the Pope's elbow. The second struck him in the abdomen and propelled him back into the arms of his secretary, Monsignor Stanislajewicz. The Pope, conscious and in great pain, alternately began to pray aloud and then silently on the way to the hospital. He later told the French writer André Frossard that while he was praying, he realized something amazing. The moment he was shot, 5 p.m. on May 13th, was exactly the moment and day on which three shepherd children had first reported seeing the Virgin Mary in Fatima in 1917. Normally, in afternoon traffic in Rome, the ride to the hospital would have taken about half an hour, but the ambulance carrying John Paul made it there in 8 minutes. When he arrived, the Pope was dying, but he was one of the few who did not think his wounds were fatal. He later said, "At the very moment I fell, I had this vivid presentiment that I would be saved." In 2005, in a chapter on the shooting in his memoir, Memory and Identity, John Paul said he had a strange feeling of confidence that he would live. He also said he didn't recall much of what had happened when he got to the hospital. He said, "I was almost on the other side." His blood pressure was falling, his pulse weakening, he lost consciousness. He was rushed into an operating room at the Gemelli Clinic. As in the case of Ronald Reagan, who had been shot in Washington, D.C. just 2 months before, the exact nature and extent of the Pope's injury was not immediately clear. The bullet that hit his abdomen had left havoc in its wake. When the surgeon made the first incision, he found blood everywhere, but the source of the hemorrhaging could not be isolated. Finally, they found there was not one wound, but many. A perforated colon, 5 wounds in the intestines. They operated on him for 5 hours. It wasn't clear until midnight that night that John Paul might make it. But to him, again, the outcome was never in doubt. He said one hand fired, another guided the bullet. He was talking about Mary. He was certain he had been saved, quite literally, by the Blessed Mother. He was certain she had, literally, with her hand, guided the bullet away from his main abdominal artery, which it had missed by 0.1 inch. If that artery had been nicked or cut, the Pope would have bled to death on the way to the hospital. As John Paul's biographer, George Weigel, noted, "It was a confession of miraculous intervention that the most secular soul might have been tempted to concede." The would-be assassin, Mehmet Ali Agha, had fired at point-blank range, and yet the bullet that missed the artery also missed the Pope's spinal column and every one of the clusters of nerves that lay in its path. You know what John Paul did with that bullet that almost killed him. It had dropped to the floor of the truck. They had gathered it up and brought it into the hospital, and there, while he was recuperating, the Pope had asked to see it. He held it in the palm of his hand as if weighing it. Then he directed that it be taken to Fatima, to the visitation site, and mounted on the filigreed gold crown on the statue of the Blessed Mother. You can see it there today, the brass bullet woven into all that gold. Soon after John Paul died, as calls for his canonization increased, the Vatican announced it would re-examine the bullet to see if more could be learned about its astounding path. John Paul himself saw it again when he went to Fatima on May 13, 1982, a year after his shooting, in a pilgrimage he described as one of thanksgiving for his life. Now, during the visitation at Fatima years ago, the Virgin Mary had famously given 3 children, Jacinto Marto, her brother Francisco, and their cousin Lucia dos Santos, a series of messages. The first involved a revelation of hell. The second said that Russia would spread error throughout the world unless that country were consecrated to her Sacred Heart. And the third message is one around which some degree of controversy continues to swirl. In 1944, Lucia, then a nun and the only surviving child of Fatima, was first asked by her superiors and then ordered by her bishop to write the original message down. She did. Eventually, the written message made its way to the Vatican, where it was not to be read until 1960. Lucia said the Blessed Mother wanted it kept secret until then. When he was recuperating in the hospital, John Paul asked for the letter and read it. It said that a bishop dressed in white would be shot because of his attempts to protect the faith. The Pope, the Bishop of Rome, who was dressed in white the day he was shot, told friends the letter had given him much to ponder. I touch again, you see, upon the supernatural. It is hard not to when writing about this Pope. His life has been shaped by a series of occurrences that invite speculation, moments that seem fateful and full of portent. No one's life, of course, is untouched by the miraculous. A new father will look at his infant child's ear, as they say, and see in it a perfection and complexity that leave him speechless. To some people, the life all around us every day seems full of some mysterious splendor. You walk off the street into a towering new skyscraper with high ceilings and cool air, and you find in the lobby floor a flower shop overflowing with perfect buds and blossoms that are vibrant and full of life. It all seems like a miracle, a brilliant creation of man housing a beautiful work of God. Beyond that, many of us, and maybe most of us, have a sense that this flat world is not all there is, but only part of what is. Things happen all around us that we don't fully understand and that we call by names like, quote, an amazing turn of events, or, quote, I had a sort of premonition, or, quote, oh, it was just one of those funny things. Some Catholics are said to be too ready to see the miraculous or the supernatural in what may be random events, but perhaps it is truer to say that they are unusually alive to such things. George Weigel, in Letters to a Young Catholic, has noted that, in essence, Catholicism is a way of seeing the world, a distinctive way of perceiving reality. It has to do with a sacramental imagination, with seeing God in all things, and with being perhaps particularly open to the physical reality of the constant and manifold interventions of a real God in a real universe. But John Paul's life has seemed especially touched by singular occurrences. He was born on May 18, 1920, in a small Polish city called Wadowice. He was the third child and second boy. A little sister had died either stillborn or in early infancy. His mother was Emilia, and his father was Karol Wojtyła, a military clerk in the local garrison. The family lived in a modest second-floor apartment at number 2 Kościelna Street. The apartment was across from the parish church, Our Lady of Perpetual Help. This is from John Franco Świderkowski's Stories of Karol. As she was going through labor at home, Emilia heard the hymns from the novena being held inside the church. She asked the midwife to open the window so she could hear the singing more clearly. She then gave birth to Karol Józef. So the first sound he heard on earth was that of human beings singing prayers. So that was his first day on earth, which happened also to be the triumphant day that Warsaw, Poland's capital, welcomed its great liberator, Marshal Józef Piłsudski, the head of state and head of the Polish army. Marshal Piłsudski had created a newly independent Poland by beating back troops of the new Soviet Union, which was attempting to take over Poland. Warsaw was full of crowds, parades, and flowers. It was a great day when Piłsudski returned home victorious from the front. Karol Wojtyła was baptized on June 20, 1920. A few days later, Lenin's army was back, advancing just outside Warsaw. The Soviets were already occupying parts of Poland. Trotsky was quoted as saying that within a year, all of Europe would be communist. The Catholic Church of Poland, sensing even then, just 3 years into Bolshevism, what communism was, called for Polish volunteers to rise up and fight the Russians. Well, the volunteers came. Some arrived for duty in their World War I uniforms. Marshal Piłsudski commanded the Polish troops and cut off the Russian advance, blunting the attack and then turning it back. The Poles called their unlikely victory a miracle, and they thought they knew who was responsible, the Blessed Virgin, who had for 1,000 years protected them. For the day of the decisive battle was August 15th, the Feast of the Assumption of Our Lady. And to this day, proud Poles will tell you it was that victory that saved Europe from communism. The Wojtyłas didn't have much. They lived modestly. As an army clerk, Karol Sr. had a small salary, and Emilia took in work as a seamstress to make ends meet. Here is an odd but, to me, intriguing historical fact. Ronald Reagan's mother took in work as a seamstress, and so did Margaret Thatcher's. So the three great leaders most responsible for the fall of communism and the reunification of Europe spent their childhoods watching their mothers joining different pieces of fabric together and making them into a whole. Young Karol Wojtyła, the future pope, was always at church and usually at Mass when the great historical occurrences of his lifetime took place. When Karol was a young man considering going into the priesthood, he was in a local church helping with Mass when the first booms of the Nazi invasion broke the glass in the church windows all around him. That's how he found out the Second World War had begun. He was in church again when the Nazis fell. He was at Mass and about to become a priest when the Russian army invaded Poland as the Nazis withdrew. He was a priest when the Russians themselves withdrew in 1989, but by then he wasn't in Poland. He was in Rome and he was the Pope. The day Karol Wojtyła's predecessor as Pope, John Paul I, died, Karol Wojtyła was in Mass at the Great Cathedral in Krakow. It was a high Mass, and it was well attended because Cardinal Wojtyła was marking the 20th anniversary of his consecration as bishop. As seminarian, priest, and bishop, Karol Wojtyła had a special devotion to a great figure of Polish antiquity, Blessed Jadwiga. Jadwiga was one of the three daughters of a 14th-century king of Poland. When he died without sons, Jadwiga was to be elevated to the throne, which she did not want. The fact that she was a girl and not a boy so irritated the Polish nobility that they said they would crown her king, not queen. She was only 10 years old. Soon a marriage was arranged for her by the leaders of the Polish court, who were attempting to solidify an alliance with Lithuania, which was strategically important to Poland, but pagan, unlike Poland, which was Catholic. Her young intended, the Grand Duke of Lithuania, agreed not only to attempt an honest conversion to Christianity, but to bring his country along with him. Jadwiga did not love him and did not want him. The legend has it that she fled to the great cathedral at Krakow, where she prayed on her knees for 3 hours before a crucifix. In the end, she agreed to the marriage after concluding its benefits to her country and her church outweighed her personal sacrifice. And so she married him at the age of 12 in 1386. In her short life, she made a great impression on her people. She was admired and loved for her sense of justice, for her warmth and patience, and for her spirit of sacrifice. She was ardent in her Christianity, and she was a mystic. Under her and her king, Poland and Lithuania combined and became the greatest power in Eastern Europe, a robust Christian commonwealth. And together, Jadwiga and her husband gave Krakow a great university, which helped make the city a leading intellectual center and a bridge between East and West. So Jadwiga was a great lady, and from the earliest days of his maturity, Karol Wojtyła venerated her. In fact, he felt such a connection with her that every year on her feast day, October 16th, the anniversary of her coronation as queen, he celebrated a Mass in her honor. He did this throughout his years as bishop, and it was on her feast day in 1978 that he was elected pope. As Ted Schultz wrote, quote, "Her name was on his lips the moment he became John Paul II." John Paul made Blessed Jadwiga, Saint Jadwiga, in 1997 in an open-air Mass in Poland. More than a century before John Paul became Pope, a great Polish poet and playwright prophesied that there would be a great moment in the future when a Pole would rise to the papacy. Now, young Karol Wojtyła knew this Polish poet's work. He'd studied him in school, and he'd even acted in one of his plays when he was a high school and college student. Here is what the poet wrote in a famous 19th century poem. He wrote, Amidst all the discord, God sets an immense bell ringing. He opens the throne to a Slavic pope. Much energy is needed to rebuild the Lord's world, and that is why a Slavic pope is coming, a brother of the peoples. There were personal prophecies that Karol Wojtyła would someday be the pontiff. The day he became the Cardinal of Krakow, a little girl and a crowd of well-wishers blurted out that he would now be pope, and though everyone laughed, he did not, and kissed her. There was the famous scene with the Italian mystic Padre Pio. It is a story that gained wide credence when John Paul first became pope. Now, Padre Pio of San Giovanni Rotondo, a town near Naples, was a 20th century stigmatic who bore the wounds of Christ on his hands, feet, and side. Padre Pio was famous for his healing gifts and for his ability to read souls. If you went into his confessional and didn't tell the truth about yourself, he'd remind you of the facts quite specifically, and if you denied them, he'd throw you out. Padre Pio was said to have the gift of appearing at two places simultaneously, literally being seen by people who had interactions with him in different places at the same moment. Such reports became so commonplace that sometimes when his assistant was asked his whereabouts, he'd breezily reply, "He's on bilocation." Padre Pio was already famous by the time a young Polish priest came to see him in 1947. According to the story, when Karol Wojtyła went into the Padre's confessional and knelt, Padre Pio rose from his chair and knelt at his feet, saying he would one day be a great pope. No one is sure if the story is true or not, at least no one who was there. There were only two people there, after all, and both are dead. The Pope himself did not speak of it, but he did reveal that a miracle came of his meeting with Padre Pio. He had a close friend, Dr. Wanda Putawska, with whom, as a young bishop, John Paul had worked on a book about sexual ethics and marriage. But he had actually known her for years, since shortly after she was arrested by the Nazis and freed 5 years later from a concentration camp. In 1962, Dr. Putawska was stricken with what doctors told her was likely a terminal cancer. She was scheduled for surgery. She told Cardinal Wojtyła, who wrote Padre Pio, and asked him to pray. When X-rays were taken just before her surgery, her cancer had completely disappeared. Said the papal biographer George Weigel, "It was, Wojtyła believed, a miracle wrought by Padre Pio's intercession, another example of the extraordinary that lay just on the other side of the ordinary." 5 years later, in 1967, Dr. Putawska went to San Giovanni Rotondo to attend Padre Pio's early morning mass. She hoped to meet him, but there were big crowds. At the end of the mass, Padre Pio walked by her and stopped. "Now are you all right?" he asked. She realized he knew who she was, though they had never set eyes on each other before. John Paul named Padre Pio a saint in 2002. There was also the incident involving the Pope's friend, Stefan Zjawadzki, a Polish scholar and philosopher. He was visiting an abbey southeast of Rome with his wife and then Cardinal Wojtyła during Easter time in 1974. The abbey was called Fossa Nuova. It was more than 800 years old. The great saint and doctor of the church, St. Thomas Aquinas, had died there in 1274. In fact, Stefan and his family and Wojtyła were there to attend a conference marking the 700th anniversary of St. Thomas Aquinas' death. Cardinal Wojtyła was saying Mass and giving as his homily an address on the two Thomases, Aquinas and the famous Doubting Thomas, the Apostle. During the homily, as Cardinal Wojtyła spoke, something came over his friend Stefan. It came to him, quote, "unbidden and unwilled, as if it were a kind of revelation," as he told George Weigel. After the Mass, Stefan went to his friend Cardinal Wojtyła and said, "You will become Pope." Now, you would think a young cardinal being told such a thing would smile or shake his head or raise an eyebrow. Instead, he looked gravely into his friend's eyes and said nothing and walked away praying. Now, all these stories are about destiny, about a sense that people had about John Paul that he would become a great man, a great leader. But none of those I've spoken of was the most famous of the prophets of a Polish pope. That would be Blessed Faustina Kowalska, another 20th century mystic known for her communications with Christ and her exhortations regarding his mercy. She was given, she said, revelations, which she wrote down in a series of notebooks. In the sixth and final notebook, which she wrote in 1928, she said, quote, "As I was praying for Poland, I heard these words. I bear a special love for Poland, and if she will be obedient to my will, I will exalt her in might and holiness. From her will come forth the spark that will prepare the world for my final coming." Unquote. Faustina, too, was recognized as a saint by John Paul II. All of these stories, I think, are captivating in a woo-woo kind of way. They suggest the possibility of an unknown and hidden meaning to things and an unknown and hidden player in events. They suggest the existence of other realities operating under unknown conditions and by other timetables. All of which, in speaking of them, can give the impression of the imaginary and the superstitious, which is perhaps why John Paul himself didn't speak of them very much. He would say simply, "In the designs of Providence, there are no mere coincidences." I will end with what happened after the shooting of the Pope. John Paul met with Mehmet Ali Agca in his prison cell and spent 2 hours with him. He listened to him, he told him about the Catholic faith, he embraced him and forgave him. It was a transcendent moment in the 20th century. The Pope had been shot by a man who meant to kill him in cold blood. The man was unrepentant, changed stories about who had sent him or whether, in fact, anyone had sent him. He consistently told lies, but not consistent ones. And yet, to this day, it is a beautiful moment that John Paul and Mehmet Ali Agca came together and talked. Now, to this day, a quarter century later, nobody knows why Mehmet Ali Agca shot the Pope, except Agca himself. The writer and investigative reporter Claire Sterling, a scholar of international terrorism, told People magazine at the time that Agca may have been acting on and spurred by a Muslim resentment of the West and of Christianity. Sterling said, quote, "I could envision a small splinter group of Muslim fanatics with Agca among them, but more likely he made the final decision alone." Later, Sterling would take another view. The obvious beneficiary of a dead Polish pope was the Soviet Union, whose dominance he threatened by his very existence. Sterling wrote later in a celebrated piece of reportage that the Bulgarian secret police, in silent concert with or directly under direction from the KGB, was likely behind the assassination attempt. Agca has told different stories. He said the Bulgarians helped him, but the Bulgarians he named were not convicted after they were brought to trial, and there was reason to believe they were never involved. By the way, in 2002, the Pope, too, said he did not see a Bulgarian connection in his shooting. Then, after saying it was the Bulgarians, Agca changed his story, then he changed it again. Sometimes he said he was acting alone. He said he was a professional terrorist for a Turkish fascist group of which he was a member, the Grey Wolves. Sometimes he'd say he'd never tell the truth. Do you know what John Paul thought? He thought it didn't matter. Those around him have long said he showed a remarkable lack of interest in the subject. John Paul's biographer Jonathan Quitney, in Man of the Century, quotes the Pope's close friend, Cardinal Desker, who spoke to John Paul during the trial of the Bulgarians. Desker said the Pope told him, quote, "I know well that the responsible one was the devil, and whether he used the Bulgarian people or the Turkish people, it was diabolical." In 2005, John Paul spoke of his assassin in Memory and Identity. He said that he had forgiven his assassin even before he knew who he was, even before he arrived at the hospital to be operated on. His forgiveness was among his last thoughts before he lost consciousness. In his memoir, John Paul called Adja a professional assassin. That, he said, means that the assassination was not his initiative, that someone else thought of it, someone else gave the order. But who? What group or individual? Well, the assassination attempt, John Paul said, was one of the last convulsions of the 20th century's ideologies of force. Force-stimulated fascism and Hitlerism, force-stimulated communism. But that in itself didn't really make things awfully or completely clear. Hitlerism was no longer an ideology of force by the time the Pope was shot. It was over. Soviet communism, which had much to gain from his death, still existed. It was, though it did not know it, in its death throes. So it was capable of a last convulsion. As for the Pope's mention of fascism, that is a term whose use is often open to interpretation. There is something Mehmet Ali Adja did before he shot the Pope that in retrospect seems to suggest more meaning than the world was necessarily sensitive to a quarter century ago. On February 1, 1979, a year and a half before his attack on John Paul, Mehmet Ali Adja shot someone else. He was part of a gang that assassinated a man named Abdi İpekçi, the editor of the most respected and influential daily newspaper in Istanbul, Milliyet. Mehmet Ali Adja was arrested and confessed his part in the crime. And then, amazingly, he walked out of his maximum security prison, the Kartal Maltepe, in Istanbul. He just walked out. It was a personal prison break that must have received great assistance, the prison being a military facility and Adja having escaped in an army uniform. Adja at this time was 23 years old. His family was poor. He was not well educated. He had no money. But at this point, he began a tour of expensive travel in first-class hotels in Europe and the Mideast. Out of jail and on the lam, he sent a letter to Milliyet. His subject was a planned upcoming visit by John Paul to Turkey. Now, this is what Adja wrote. He wrote, "Western imperialists, fearful that Turkey and her sister Islamic nations may become a political, military, and economic power in the Middle East, are sending to Turkey at this delicate moment the commander of the Crusades, John Paul, disguised as a religious leader. If this visit is not called off, I will definitely kill the Commander Pope." Obviously, this was an amazing letter in many respects. We do not know if it truly reflected Adja's views. It could have been written by him under the direction of communist controllers who'd gotten him out of jail and were putting in place the paper trail of a false Adja motive. Adja, when questioned about the letter later, said he sent it to distract the police from the search for him by prompting them to devote greater resources to protecting the Pope during his visit to Turkey. But, as we know, Adja often lied, and if he was trying to divert the attention of the police from himself, it is very odd that he signed his name to the letter. At any rate, after the Pope was shot, after he had forgiven Adja, John Paul found himself pondering whether Adja understood that the man he had tried to kill had freely and fully forgiven him. He realized he wanted to tell him this himself. And so, during Christmas week 1983, on December 27th, the Pope went to the Rebibbia prison in Rome. There he celebrated Mass. Then he went to Adja's cell, where they sat together, just the two of them, on plastic chairs. They talked. Ajah, amazingly enough, shared with the Pope his confusion about how things had played out. He was a good shot. He aimed true. He had his escape planned. And yet, in the end, all was thwarted. How could this have happened? Ajah told John Paul that he had heard that he had shot the Pope on the anniversary of the Virgin Mary coming down to talk to children in Fatima. Yes, said the Pope, it was true what he'd heard. And yes, he, John Paul, attributed his survival to the intercession of the Virgin. The Pope said he believed her hand had diverted the bullet Ajah had shot. Ajah then leaned in and told the Pope he was afraid of something. He said he feared that the Virgin would take revenge on him. He was afraid, he said, that, quote, the goddess of Fatima, unquote, was going to kill him in his cell. Well, the Pope listened. He told Ajah the story of Fatima, and he explained that Mary wasn't a goddess and wasn't vengeful. He said she was the mother of God and that she loved Ajah. John Paul told Ajah, do not fear her. Later, the Pope would say he felt he had reached Ajah. He wrote, Ali Ajah, as I believe, understood that above his power, the power of shooting and killing, there is greater power. He began looking for it. I wish for him that he finds it. And so the Pope talked to and allayed the fears of the man who had tried to kill him. Now that moment, the two of them sitting on plastic chairs in a prison cell, is a great moment. If goodness could be concentrated into light, one of the most brilliant and radiant flashes of the past century happened in that little cell in the Rebibbia prison. And the story ends with what happened to the Pope in 2005 as he was dying. In February, he was hospitalized for 10 days because of difficulty breathing, which was said at the time to be connected to the flu. While in the hospital, he received many letters and notes and calls. One, a note which wished him good health and a quick recovery, was from Mehmet Ali Ajah. On April 2nd, when John Paul II died, one of the very first requests to attend the funeral came from Ajah, but prison officials turned him down.